44 years ago today, that was the call from Al Michaels. Do you believe in miracles? Yes. 44 years ago today, the United States beat the USSR 4-3 in what many people believe was the gold medal match. And it was not. It was the semis. And then the USA had to win the gold medal match to really cap it off. And they absolutely did. Darren Revell put on Twitter, "The greatest pregame speech in coaching history happened 44 years ago today. The U.S. team shocks the Russians, goes on to win gold. Here's what Herb Brooks said to his team on that night before they played the Soviet Union." This is back in 1980. "Great moments born from great opportunity. And that's what you have here tonight, boys. That's what you've earned here tonight. One game. If we played them 10 times, they might win 9. But not this game. Not tonight. Tonight we skate with them, tonight we stay with them, and we shut them down because we can. Tonight we are the greatest hockey team in the world. You were born to be hockey players, every one of you, and you were meant to be here tonight. This is your time, their time is done. It's over. I'm sick and tired of hearing about what a great hockey team the Soviets have. Screw them. This is your time. Now go out there and take it." I'm ready to go do some stuff right now. That's pretty awesome speech. That's a pretty awesome speech from Herb Brooks. Of course, there's been documentaries, movies, you know, based off of this and everything. But 44 years ago today, the USA shocked the world and beat the USSR and then went on to win the gold medal.
Yeah, I was obviously not around, but the documentaries and the movie Miracle is one of my favorite sports movies that's out there. Mm-hmm. There's parts of that movie where you just get chills, you know, during it when Mike Caruzione finally says, "I play for the United States of America," instead of everybody saying what college they're from, right? Mm-hmm. That moment in the movie is always one that gets me. And even though I wasn't alive when it happened, it's something that is ingrained in my memory. That call obviously is in there, even though that was before I was here. And it's like, but that's how you know those moments are just gigantic, right?
Absolutely.
It's like, you know about them even if you weren't even remotely part of them.
Right.
And so that is, that's a very cool moment for sure in this country's sports history. There's no doubt about that.
No doubt. And it was also a moment that brought the country together, too.
Yes.
Like, everybody could rally around that hockey team with those young kids taking down the older Soviet team that was just loaded.
That team. Yeah.
I mean, it was a sense of pride.
When the Cold War is still going on, you know,
yes, and absolutely.
All that stuff, that's easy to rally around for sure.
Yeah, no question about it. Welcome to Sports Ticket, brought to you by Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit, your home for fast, friendly auto repair. K-State women with a big win last night. We'll talk about that coming up. Also, we've got lots of local sports to get to. And also, there was a top 25 upset in college basketball last night. It was interesting. Yesterday, I was talking about this on the show, and we went through the top 25 in men's college basketball and said, how many of these are actually true national title contenders? Dusty had 10, I said possibly 12, and there is a stat that came out yesterday that I saw that narrows it down to 8. There's only 8 that are qualified to win the national title this year based on a couple of metrics, so we'll go over that and see if you agree with it. And a World Series hero, one of my favorite players with the Royals, is retiring, so we'll tell you who that is. And there is an NFL coach in AFC West that somehow thinks he has it figured out and has their own set of rules for Patrick Mahomes. And by the way, they didn't make the playoffs, but, you know, whatever. That's coming up here in just a little bit as well. But first, we turn it over to Dusty as the state wrestling tournament gets underway. Class 4, 3, 2, 1A. They're all in Salina. It's a 3-day tournament instead of a 2-day tournament. In the past, it's been 3, 2, 1A out at Hayes. Last year, the girls had their own state tournament separate, but in Salina. And then the boys, 3, 2, 1A had Hayes. You had Salina's hosted boys wrestling tournaments before. But because of some conflicts and issues with Hayes and everything else, 1, 2, 3, and 4A are in Salina at the Tony Events Center, also known as the Bicentennial Center. That's how I always remember it. Mm-hmm. And it's girls and boys. So it's going to drag out to make it a big, long three-day tournament. But at the same time, everybody will be under the same roof. So it should be very interesting. And we have some area wrestlers competing beginning today.
Yes, and I'll talk about that here in a second. But logistically, it's kind of a nightmare for some of the people that are trying to get to 3 days sometimes, yes. Right? But at the same time, like you said, it's all under one roof. And there's going to be a lot of great wrestling. If you're a fan of the sport, mm-hmm. and you can actually make it to the state tournament, this is going to be a fun state tournament to watch and be a part of, for yes. sure. So you can see, you know, everything from 4 through 1A girls and boys coming up here this weekend. So, yeah, get started today. We have 11 area athletes from the immediate area, 10 on the boys' side and 1 on the girls' side. So 10 and 3, 2, 1A. Boys, for Beloit, Brogan Monty was a regional champ a week ago, and then Brody Boudreaux finished second. And then you have two wrestlers for, well, one for Osborne and Caden Schultz, and then one for Lakeside as well in Grant Middleton. And then you have 5 from Smith Center. Eli Franklin's a defending state champion at 215, and then his brother Luke's back to state. Carson Montgomery at 285 is also at state this year. And then Parker Hutchinson at 150 and Gannon McCoy are making their first state appearances. And then Casey Harrodsburg's also wrestling for the Smith Center girls here this weekend, 4 through 1A state tournament. And then our final area qualifier is Alec Huck from Sylvan Lucas. So he's wrestling at 190. So, again, 11 total that'll be on the mats. And we're going to have reports throughout the next 3 days. Coming up today, we'll probably have our first one. Girls wrestling starts at 1:30, so we'll probably have our first report around 2 o'clock this afternoon on Kitty Country 94. Maybe give it an update every half hour up until about 6:30, and then I'll be going on a pregame with high school basketball tonight. So that's how it's going to look today as far as our reports. They're going to start with girls, as we mentioned, at 2, and then the 3-2-1A boys first round matches will start at 5:15 here today. Kind of the schedule there, the early morning session, or not early morning, but the morning session is 4-1A or 4A boys, and then 4-1A girls will start at 1:30 here this afternoon with our first reports at 2 o'clock. So again, we had a chance to sit down and talk with the coaches. Again, for Beloit, Brogan Monty is looking to defend a state championship. He was a 106 state champion last year, and he's wrestling up at 113 this year. And then Brody Boudreaux, who was a regional runner-up last week, is looking to have a good state tournament as well. And Kate Hewitt, the coach of the Beloit Trojans, likes the draws that his wrestlers got for this weekend.
Brogan Monty got the number one seed in his bracket. I really like where he sits in the bracket and his opportunity to return to the finals and try to put state championship number 2 on the wall. Looking at Brody Boudreaux, we got a great draw in the bracket. We've been telling Brody, don't overlook that first match. Go out and dominate matchup number 1. I really think it will propel his momentum.
We look at Brogan, I mean, the expectation there is to win a state championship at 113. He's 32-3. He's not lost to anybody 3A or lower in his entire career in the state of Kansas. So he's expected to win that here this weekend. And Brody has a good chance, like you heard from Coach Hewitt as well. Osborne, Caden Schultz at 157 is a returning state qualifier. And then Grant Middleton made it last year as a freshman as well and is back as a sophomore. Both of those wrestlers are sophomores. Grant wrestling for Lakeside as he wrestles for Osborne during the season. And Osborne coach Jason Noll on their prospects for the weekend.
Caden's hitting pretty good. We'll have a tough match that first round, of course. He's built a lot of confidence, too. And Grant, it's going to be tough. Going to have to wrestle probably the best tournament he has in the last 2 years to get a win and get on the medal stand. Hopefully we can get 2 on the medal stand. And if we don't, I know they're going to leave it all on the mat.
Yeah, that 215-pound weight class is stacked, by the way. You talked about Grant, and Brody Boudreaux made it in that class for Beloit, and then Eli Franklin of Smith Center is the defending state champion in that class. We have 3 in our area alone that have qualified, and then Luke Fisher of Larned is 43-0 and number 1. He was a state champion at a lower weight class last year. So that's a stacked weight class, a tough one for Grant, but we'll see what he can do. As we mentioned, Eli Franklin of Smith Center, defending state champion, Luke Franklin, Carson Montgomery, Parker Hutchinson, Gannon McCoy, and also, as we mentioned, Casey Harrodsburg wrestling for the Smith Center girls this weekend. And Avery Hawkins, the head coach of Smith Center, really likes his chances for the kids to get on the medal stand here this weekend.
You get to the state tournament, everybody's good. Guys will talk about good draws, or we got a good draw here, we got a bad draw here. I don't know if there's good or bad draws ever. I mean, everybody's good. They've all proved that they deserve to be in the state tournament and compete against the best in the state. So, you know, I think we definitely have some challenging first-round matches. If we can get through those, we might have a shot of winning a couple more on the front side. I think the back side of our brackets are pretty favorable. You know, if we do happen to drop one, I think we can battle our way back. And I honestly do think that everybody can get out of there with a medal.
And that was Avery Hawkins, coach of the Smith Center wrestling teams. Again, state wrestling starting today. Girls 4 through 1A at 1:30. There's three rounds today. The first round of competition, then championship quarters, consolation first round. In all those classes, then there's the same concept there at 5:15 when the 3-2-1A boys start. There'll be three rounds tomorrow with consolation second round, championship semifinals, and consolation quarterfinals. And then on Saturday, everybody will wrestle together with consolation semis, fifth, third, and championship matches. So it's kind of the way the schedule looks. If you're confused about any of that, that entire schedule, as well as all the area state qualifiers and the links to live results are all posted at nckssports.com for 3-2-1A boys, 4-1A girls state wrestling, and 4A boys wrestling as well here this weekend. So I'm looking forward to seeing how all of our area athletes will compete at state wrestling.
Absolutely. And not only do you have state wrestling, now you have postseason basketball starting tonight and tomorrow in Class 1A. We have basketball games, one tonight for you, one for you tomorrow night, right here on Katy Country 94 and katycountry94.com. And you get a boys matchup between the Grizzlies and the Knights.
Yes, the third matchup of the year between Lakeside and Rock Hills. Lakeside hosting that one in the first round of the quarterfinals as the higher seed, the number three seed with a record of 9-8. Rock Hills coming in at 6-12. They're the sixth seed in this tournament. Both these games, though, were close earlier this year. Lakeside by won by 7 at the preseason tournament in Downs in December. Then in early February, they won by 8 in Mankato. As you look at this matchup, Lakeside coach Drew Dusky looking at the Grizzlies and knowing that it will be a tough matchup here tonight and not just an easy one because they've won twice already.
It's going to be a tough game, and it's going to go down to the wire. I mean, kind of like the last two games have. We're going to have to play our best game. They're probably going to stick to playing us in a zone, and sometimes our offense doesn't look great against the zone, so we're going to have to find the gaps, and we're going to have to shoot the ball well from the outside to open some things up inside for Reese.
You know, last time the Lakeside played Rock Hills, it was up in Mankato, and that's when Caden McCoy went down with a season-ending injury. So they're playing one guy short this time around against Rock Hills. Coach Duffy for the Grizzlies likes the way his team has continued to improve this season and knows that tonight, though, with Lakeside, will be a challenge. Zach Duffy from Rock Hills.
They're going to be well coached, and they've got the Cunningham kid and the Remus kid that are both real solid players. And I just always say, you know, when you play Lakeside, I feel like they have well-defined roles. They know exactly what's expected of them and what they do well and what they don't do well. And they don't typically try to play outside themselves or do anything they shouldn't. Offensively, you know, typically we see a man from them, and it's a solid man. And we're going to have to take care of the ball.
Yeah, that last sentence there, take care of the ball, those last three words are the thing for Rock Hills boys. You know, I've done some games this year where they've struggled to do that, and Lincoln was probably the prime example of that earlier this year. So if they can take care of the basketball, they've shown that they can score and do the things needed to stay in games and then win them at the ends. So we're looking forward to this matchup tonight. Again, Lakeside, Rock Hills. Well, pregame at 6:50 and tip-off at 7 o'clock for Lakeside and Rock Hills tonight on Katy Country 94 and katycountry94.com. You can find the full brackets for Substate Basketball at nckssports.com. Also in that 1A Division I Rock Hills, Substate Frankfort is hosting Washington County in the 4-5 matchup. And then Sylvan Lucas is hosting Wakefield in 1A D1 Substate action tonight. That's part of the Solomon Substate, 1A Division II, the Golden Plains Substate. Thunder Ridge is at Rexford to play Golden Plains. And then 1A Division II Blue Valley Randolph Substate. Pike Valley is hosting Blue Valley Randolph. And Southern Cloud is at Lynn tonight. St. John's Tipton has the number one seed in their 1A Division II Stafford Substate, so they won't be on the court tonight. Neither will Osborne, who is the number one seed on the boys' side in 1A Division I Rock Hills Substate. Again, full brackets, nckssports.com for Substate basketball.
And the Class 2A and 3A Substate brackets came out yesterday as well, and this will all begin on Monday and Tuesday of next week. Class 2A girls, the Smith Center girls are 15-5. They're the 2 seed. They'll take on 1-18 Hill City, the 7 seed in Smith Center at 7 o'clock on Monday. If they win that, they could have a rematch against a TMP team that beat them by basic almost 20 recently. So that's a, and then Hoxie's in the top half, and their only loss is to Smith Center.
Mm-hmm.
So, and last year Hoxie knocked out Smith Center in sub-state finals in basketball. So that's an interesting sub-state there for Smith Center and the Lady Red and head coach Nick Lynn's crew. The Smith Center boys having their best season in quite some time, and they will be at the Oakley Substate, but they will host a first-round game. Despite having a losing record at 9-11, they are the 3 seed. They'll take on 6-14 Oakley. If they win that, they will play in Oakley coming up on Friday against either Plainville or Ellis. And once again, Smith Center boys will play at home. That'll be a 6 o'clock start on Tuesday against Oakley. Smith Center girls will play at 7 o'clock at home on Monday against Hill City.
Let me slide in real fast. Coach Hobelman told me on the locker room chat yesterday this is the first time since 2011 that Smith Center has hosted a first-round substate.
Well, that was the last time they had a winning season.
Yeah.
So that would make sense.
Yeah,
it would make sense.
That is wild.
Yeah.
He's got them going in the right direction.
Yeah.
No question about it.
I didn't have a chance to talk about it yesterday because you were going back and forth with studio. It's hard to
absolutely
bounce
I
off
get
people.
That. Yeah.
Alex Holdman's team has vastly improved from a year ago, and I was impressed with them the other night. Now, they struggled second half and believe turned up the defensive intensity, but they've got a couple of young players that could be really good for them in the future. And so there's no doubt that they are trending in the right direction. So I'm glad that you brought that up. And that is pretty amazing. It's been 13 years since they hosted a substate game. So I try to tell all these other high school programs,
yeah.
You know, kind of like Chiefs fans, you know, it just doesn't happen all the time, your entire lifetime. So, you know, enjoy it. Of course, Smith Center has had so much success in wrestling, girls volleyball, girls basketball, football, of course,
with
10 state titles, whatever it is. And then boys basketball is always – do you know last time they made state in boys basketball?
Ooh, I don't know that. Has it been in this century?
Technically, no.
Okay, 99 then?
It was 1954.
Oh, wow.
According to my information, 1954.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. When I was in high school,
yeah,
Smith Center wasn't a team we were overly worried about on
right.
the boys' side, right?
Like, nope.
Girls were, for sure.
Right.
They had to play against, Dana and Denise and all them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They definitely had talent. The 3A girls substate, the Beloit girls lost the coin flip. It's interesting. A lot of people would be like, oh, we got to be having a home game. You know, you talk to Brian Weatherman, head coach of Minneapolis. You talked to Sean Arenas, head coach of Beloit. They almost both seem to let you know that they're actually better on the road than at home and almost would prefer to be on the road. So when we say Beloit lost the coin flip, maybe they won the coin flip because they are going on the road. So Beloit will be at Minneapolis. That'll be Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. We'll have it for you on KD Country 94 and KDCountry94.com. Pregame around 6:45. That's the rubber match, as Beloit won at Minneapolis earlier in the year. Minneapolis won at Beloit recently, and the rubber match to decide who keeps their season alive. Beloit 15-5, and they don't get a first-round game at home. And Marysville is the 8th seed, and they're 10-10. There's not a single team in the 3A substate girls hosted by Riley County that has a losing record. Marysville would be the number 2 seed in the 3A substate at Royal Valley. Because Hayden's the only winning team, the Beloit girls would be the 2 seed. Everybody in this substate bracket would be the 2 seed. Except Nemaha Central, they'd be a 1, and Silver Lake would be a 1, as they are now, as they're number 1 in the state. Silver Lake is undefeated. So the winner of Minneapolis Beloit girls would play at Riley County on Friday against more than likely Silver Lake, although Marysville is coming on. Rossville's a very good team at the bottom of the bracket, 17-3. Take on Riley County, 11-8. They know each other very well. And Nemaha Central takes on St. Mary's. And Nemaha Central, 18-2. St. Mary's, 11-8. And that'll be an interesting matchup as well. So the girls' matchups across the board, I think, in the 3A substate hosted by Riley County, but first round games at the higher seed site are going to be very, very intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
3A boys' substate, Beloit, the number 1 team in the state in 3A. They are 19-1. They've won 9 in a row. They will take on Minneapolis for the third time this year. And Minneapolis, Beloit's beaten them handily the first 2 times, although Minneapolis hung around for a while the last time they played here very recently in Beloit on senior night. St. Mary's and Silver Lake are the 4-5 matchup on Monday at St. Mary's. We'll have Beloit hosting Minneapolis Monday pregame at 6:45 on Katie Country 94 and KatieCountry94.com from Beloit. Rossville's a 2 seed. They host Riley County. Rossville's 14-6. And Nemaha Central's 14-6. They're the 3 seed. They'll take on Marysville's 10-10. all those games coming up on Monday night. Now, when you look at records, you say, well, Beloit's got a pretty favorable sub-state. And there are some other sub-states that are maybe tougher in regards to the top heaviness of a sub-state with three pretty good teams or something like that. But I should point out that Silver Lake just beat Rock Creek. And Rock Creek was the other day the number two seed in the 4A. That's East-West. I don't know which one they were. It's hard to know anymore because of how the schools and the line is cut. I don't have it in front of me. But the point I'm trying to make is that Silver Lake beat a very good Rock Creek team. And Rossville lost to Rock Creek by 4. Silver Lake beat Rossville recently in overtime. Nemaus Central's a good team. So, and St. Mary's has beaten Silver Lake twice, and this is the third matchup, but the last one was a three-point game. So I have no idea who's going to win the St. Mary's-Silver Lake game. I figure Beloit will be okay in their game, unless there's a stunning upset. So Beloit's going to have a tough sub-state semifinal, which, you know, that's the way it's supposed to be. And then if they make it sub-state final, they'll probably take on either Rossville or Nemaha Central. Rossville's been playing some good basketball. So, and just, you know, last year, the number one team in the state in 3A going into the sub-state was Sabetha. They were undefeated, and they lost to a team that had beaten twice earlier in the year, Nemaha Central, a rivalry situation. Now, Beloit doesn't face anybody at all that they've seen already this year except the first round game against Minneapolis, which they'll be a heavy favorite in. So that's probably a good thing for Beloit from that standpoint. But just because you are a highly ranked team doesn't guarantee you jack squat going into sub-state and then trying to qualify for state. So keep that in mind. In regards to, I don't want to spend, you know, people have heard me before talk about how there's no doubt that we could have a better setup when it comes to spreading out these teams so we don't have so many great teams in one sub-state and then easy sub-states. And if you think the Beloit girls sub-state is very difficult, which it is, no losing records, which is insane. Southeast Saline is 15-5 as well. They are a 5. They're on the road.
Yeah.
But one step further in that sub-state hosted by Southeast, the 6-seed Smoky Valley is 14-6. Let that sink in. The 6-seed Smoky Valley at 14-6, they're on the road as a 6. They're 14-6. If they were in the Royal Valley sub-state, they would be the 2-seed behind Hayden. Hayden has a cakewalk to a state tournament berth, as if they need any more advantages.
Yeah, exactly.
We've talked about travel. There's tons of travel already. So teams aren't going to forfeit if they have to travel a long way. Would it be ideal? Maybe not. If we're worried about cost, well, then we should never even think about shot clocks. Yeah. Because the two excuses we hear are travel, geography, location, and then because of all that travel, more expense for the school. But yet we're sitting here telling, hey, you can do a trial run with a shot clock, but Keisha's not going to provide the shot clock for you to try out. And these other ones, you know, where we're headed is, yeah, we're going to have a shot clock at some point in time. Well, the schools are going to be having to pay the freight for that. So it's kind of talking out both sides of your mouth at once. And there was a proposal that was out there. I've been told by multiple sources that have been in some of these meetings and look at this proposal that was out there to try to make things better for basketball. There will be a new system for volleyball next year, from what I understand, which will make things a little bit more even prior to going to state. But there was a proposal out there, and I've been told the way it was put together, the people that put it together and presented it kind of knew it wasn't going to pass because there were some things that it weren't adjusted that could have given it a better chance to pass. That's what I've been told by multiple sources. So now then that leads to the question, does Keisha really want to change it? They say they do what the members want, except when it comes to a trial option on a shot clock for 80% of the 1A through 4A schools. But hey, I digress. Anyway, so you think Beloit sub-state's tough with the Riley County sub-state for the 3A girls? Southeast Saline sitting here going, hold my beer. We got a really tough one, too. And then you look at some of these other sub-states that are pretty easy. And then you look at 1A. 1A, listen, we've said it 1,000 times until we're blue in the face. There should not be two divisions in 1A. It waters it down. You don't even have to win 3 games now to make state. I think you should have to win at least 3. Now you only have to win 2. You've got some states where the number one seed is a 500 record or barely over 500, and they don't even have to play in the first round. It's not as hard to make state, clearly, in 1A as it is in other classes. That's obvious. Anybody argues that doesn't know what they're talking about. Okay, now, some sub-states in 1A, even if it's Division 1 and Division 2, you know, if you're in the, you know, ask Centralia and Hanover if they're always in the same sub-state, you know, up that way or something, or Frankfurt, you know, sometimes they get split up a little bit, sometimes they don't. And they would sit and go, well, it's still pretty darn tough to make it to state. Well, yeah, because we don't do what I just said earlier, spread it out to where we get the best possible ever state basketball tournaments, that we spread out these teams so we don't have five beaten up on each other that are ranked in the top 10 in an 8-team bracket, and then three other sub-states have no ranked teams, and teams with, like, Hoisington girls are 13-7, and they are tied for the one seed in their sub-state. 13-7. They would be the 7 seed at the Southeast of Saline 3A substate tournament. They would be the 6 seed at the Beloit 3A substate that's hosted by Riley County. So you can't tell me we can't make that better? Of course we can. It's kind of like when we talk about our politicians in Washington. There's all kinds of things they can do. The question is, do they really want to do it? You know,
yeah,
that's the question absolutely. You throw out there. And I've always heard, where there's a will, there's a way. Well, there's a will amongst many schools and leaders at some of these schools. But is there a will at the higher classifications in regards to the higher ups that are in control of this organization? That is the question. Obviously, there's a will to take care of the bigger schools. The question is there a true will to make it better for the smaller schools? And I think a lot of people, you know how they would answer that.
Yeah. I think what you bring up is about 1A is, I think that probably, you know, it's aggravating when you see that sub-state that you talked about, the Smoky Valley and Southeast of Saline girls are in, right?
Yeah.
But it's also aggravating in 1A when there's less chances for teams to make it, because there's less schools, because you've split them up into two divisions, right? So why are we putting – I mean, Rock Hill sub-state is a great example of this, of the problem that you have. And on the girls' side, I mean, girls and boys, Osborne's the number one seed. They're in a sub-state with Clifton Clyde that's, you know, obviously going to be in the top part of that. Osborne girls, the number one seed. I mean, you got 1-16-3, 2-15-3, and 3-15-5. And there's a 9-11 team in 1A Division II that has a first-round bye. Yeah. And it's like these are all in the same one. And this is another classification that could easily, with the smaller amount of schools,
could still do
in Division
better.
One and Division Two, would have an easier path to try to do what 4A, 5A, and 6A are doing, because there's not as many schools.
Right.
And so that's the aggravating part of it for me watching 1A, is like, you're throwing all these schools in. I think there's a certain 1A Division Two defending state champion on the girls' side that has a pretty easy walk to state. And you know, they probably would earn that anyway.
Right.
I did hear they have an injury, but it's like, there's just like so much about it that it's like, but I will say this, like, it's easy in volleyball to make that change, like you talked about, because we're focusing on just one group, right? In basketball,
there's girls
and boys both. And so you're never going to be able to make that work the right way in the system that we have right now, because
listen,
you know, Rock Hills could be good in boys basketball and average at best in girls basketball, and then that system's just not going to work.
Yeah, that's one
of the sub-states that have loaded on one side and not.
That is one of the challenges, is the girls and boys aspect, like you said, because you know, you can look at these two loaded 3A girls sub-states, well, then look on the boys side, and honestly, they're both pretty still solid. But sometimes you have a boys sub-state that's easy and a girls sub-state that's loaded, like you mentioned. So that's very possible. And
I'm not saying it can't be fixed. I'm just saying that that magnifies, like, when people say, oh, this girl's sub-state is too good and we should probably change this. Well, it's two different sub-states. It's not just one.
Right. Yeah, there's the girls and the boys. Right. Now, there's other ways you can do that, too. And, you know,
for sure,
one of the things that I've heard and read is, you know, you have 4-16, you know, you go 4-16-team quadrants. And we're talking about 2A and 3A. 4-16-team quadrants. And you have the games at the higher seeded site the first two rounds until you get to the semifinals. And the semifinals and finals of those 16-team brackets are played at the number one seed site unless they don't have the facilities host, and then you got to decide amongst the four that would be remaining, or if you want to predetermine it, it might be the sixth best team, but they have the best facilities, so this ends up being there. Because I do understand the planning purposes. You want to plan ahead as much as you can. That's one of the things that's good about having this predetermined for the season, although then you don't have any idea who's going to be great and who's good. You have an idea, but you know, you don't know how loaded these sub-states are going to be, in fairness to Geisha. Other state activity associations and other states have done, you know, probably better job of divvying this up to where you have more balanced setups, but there is no perfect solution. And in defense of Geisha, there is no perfect solution. No matter what they do, it'll be ripped and vilified about something that you don't like. That's just the way we roll in society. There is no perfect solution. But you know, one thing I've heard is, well, there's a lack of officials. Like, that's an excuse. And I'm sitting there going, you know what? That is an excuse, but that's an excuse all year long. That's not just separate for postseason play. But if you had four 16-team quadrants and you you have the first-round games at the higher-seeded site, okay, that might make it tough on the officiating. I get that, the first round of those situations. But I will say, once you get to the semifinals, you can have refs doing two games, and they're already there doing doubleheaders, as you do sometimes with like various other things in postseason play. So yeah, there's ways to make it better. I can't tell you I have the perfect solution, because there isn't one out there. There are some states near us that seem to have a pretty good beat on things, and there are a lot of people think that change needs to happen so that we avoid all of this. And, you know, we've changed the football playoff system over the years, and it's gotten better, but there's still people complaining, how's this team, you know, playing this team in the second round of the playoffs? And I would argue, well, at least you're getting to play it out. You know, so forth and so on. So it's, like I said, it's not easy. I get it. But it is very frustrating to see a sub-state with seven losing teams and another sub-state that doesn't have a single losing team. It's like, dear Lord. And they're not that far away from each other geography-wise. You could easily swap three or four and then have a much better sub-state tournament for both.
Yeah.
You know, instead of a cakewalk for one. But it is what it is. All right, athletes of the week. We're going to have a couple this week. We've got a girls' basketball athlete of the week today, and a boys' basketball athlete will reveal tomorrow. Who's the girls' basketball athlete of the week today?
Bethany Similink, sophomore from Rock Hills High School, is our athlete of the week in girls' basketball from NCKSSports.com, Cunningham Telephone and Cable. Similink's been on a scoring tear over her last six games. She set career highs in each of the last two for the Lady Grizzlies. And over the past two games, she's averaging 27 points, 4 assists, 4.5 steals, and 3.5 rebounds, shooting 50% from the floor and 87% from the free throw line, and made 4 of 6 threes as well in those two wins, 44-39 over Thunder Ridge Friday and 64-46 loss to Osborne. I said two wins. I meant one win, one loss. Obviously, the 64-46 loss to Osborne Tuesday. But new career high in both games, putting up 24, and including 13 of 16 from the charity stripe in the Thunder Ridge win. Better than that on Tuesday in the loss to Osborne. New career high, 30 points. 8 of 13 shooting, 13 of 14 from the free throw line. She made her first 13 and also made a three-pointer in the game. In the third quarter alone against the Lady Dogs, Similink had 14 points and went 10 of 10 in the free throw line. She added 6 steals, 4 rebounds, 2 assists Tuesday. 20 or more points in 6 consecutive games for Bethany. In that stretch, Rock Hills went 5-1, and she averaged 23.5 points, 52% from the floor, 56% from 3 at 10 of 18, and 81% at the free throw line, 54-67. She's been the leading scorer all season for Rock Hills. This team started the year 1-7, and they're 9-9. Heading into the postseason. So she's obviously had a very big impact in what she's able to do, averaging 16.5 points, 4 assists, 3.5 steals, and 3 rebounds, shooting 39% from the floor on the season, 35% from long range, and 68% on the year from the free throw line. Bethany's had an outstanding year, and Rock Hills is not a deep team, and she's had to lead them. And so you also look at that and understand that she is the focal point, her and Hallie Meisner, of an offense, and she's still averaging 23.5 points a game over the last 6 games. So,
and just a sophomore.
And a sophomore, exactly. Yeah. So I don't, you know, people are going to talk about competition, and I don't care about that. When you're on a tear that she's on right now,
yeah,
it was impressive to see her in a game against Osborne where her team, you know, really wasn't in it for most of it there late after that big run in the second quarter. And I mean, she never gave up. I mean, scoring 14 points in one quarter and keeping her team at least respectable in the game.
Well, congratulations to her, and you can read all about that at nckssports.com. Sports Ticket brought to you by Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit, your home for fast, friendly auto repair. In 30 seconds, the K-State women with a huge win last night at home.
I'm Elijah at Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit. You depend on your vehicle every day to get you where you need to go. The best way to keep it ready and avoid breakdowns is through proper maintenance. Whether it's oil, fluids, filters, spark plugs, belts, hoses, or brakes, we can help. Give yourself the peace of mind of knowing your vehicle is ready to go. For fast, friendly vehicle maintenance, call Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit. Find us just south of the courthouse or on the web at KieferBrothers.com.
Wildcats hoping to host games here in Bramlage Coliseum, where they stay unbeaten, 15-0, thanks to that young lady, Ayoka Lee. 17 straight, won by Kansas State, dating back to last year.
Well, I tell you, I was able to tune into this game with about 4 minutes left in the fourth quarter. And K-State,
worst time to tune in.
Yeah, if you're a K-State fan, absolutely, because the K-State women and I always have a soft spot for them because I've covered them over the years, you know, filling in, and I get to know, you know, obviously Coach Mitty and some of the players here and there, and of course you got the connection of Phillipsburg with Terrence Sides. I know Coach Sides and some of his family and everything, but I'm watching last night and I'm going, oh no, please make free throws. And then they miss free throws, and then they allow West Virginia to get a layup in a full court situation on inbounds with 4 seconds remaining, which was, oh my. And when that went in, I thought, at the buzzer to force overtime, I thought, oh no. But K-State got things figured out, and Ayoka Lee is the story. And by the way, it's pretty nice to just throw the ball up and know she's going to go grab it, because West Virginia didn't have the size to match up with her. But K-State missed 2 of their 4 free throw attempts in the final 14 seconds regulation. Ayoka Lee missed one as well of the 2 misses. West Virginia got that layup to tie the game at the buzzer, but K-State then won in overtime, 73-64, over number 22 West Virginia. K-State ranked 10th. And Ayoka Lee was kind of on a minutes restriction, and she played 26 minutes out of a possible 45, and scored 34 points, 10 in overtime. She had 12 rebounds for a double-double. She made her last 6 free throws after starting 4 of 8 from the line. K-State as a team was 19 of 31 from the line, which is a lot better because at one point they were 10 of 21. Yeah. And they made 9 out of 10 in overtime. As I said, Lee made the last 6. K-State women now 23-4, 12-3 in the Big 12, tied for second place in Big 12 with Texas and right on the heels of Oklahoma. West Virginia now 22-4 overall, 11-4 in the Big 12. With the 12th Big 12 win of the season, K-State has secured the program's most league wins since 2007-08. K-State collected its 5th win this season over an AP top 25 opponent. K-State women are one of only 8 teams in America with 5 or more wins against AP ranked opponents. So, big win for K-State last night, and they do, as Brian Smoller mentioned, and he does a wonderful job calling the games. As he mentioned there, they've got a decent or a good shot to host the first 2 rounds NCAA tournament right there at Bramlage, where they've been averaging about 7,000 people in attendance here recently. But Jeff Mitty, afterwards, his interview, he was like, I'm just going to be quite frank with you, I'm a little bit disappointed. Mm-hmm. And I was too, because I could see a lot of empty seats. And this was top 25 teams. Now, on a Wednesday night, and people could say and make an excuse Wednesday night, and that's a load of crap. Because if it's KU K-State on Wednesday night, that place is packed for men's basketball. If it's K-State versus Baylor, it's pretty close to packed, if not packed. If it's a ranked matchup or K-State's got a chance to pull off this upset, men's basketball on a Wednesday night, Tuesday night, I don't care what night of the week it is, that place is close to packed, if not packed. For the women, they've been having really good crowds. Last night, not as good as I thought it would be or should be. I agree with Coach Mitty. But as he said, the people that were there, don't take away from them. They were there supporting. They were loud. It's still a home court advantage.
They were loud, for sure,
yeah,
the people that were there.
But there should have probably been more. But K-State does win in overtime, and the K-State women, a big, big win for them.
I'd have liked to have been there, but it's a busy week.
That's all I know.
I honestly would have gone if it wouldn't have been everything else that's going on this week here. But, you know, and I can make that excuse, too. I don't live in Manhattan.
Sure.
The people that live in Manhattan, you know, get out to the game. I mean, there's plenty of people just in town
game.
To go to this game, right?
It was a 6:30.
And I don't disagree with Coach Mitty about that part of it. You know what? I actually wasn't all that worried when the game went into overtime that they were going to lose. I thought they'd probably pull it off in overtime. What I was most frustrated about is you had to have Ayoka Lee go out there and play 5 more minutes or whatever it was. She didn't play. You know, Moppy came in for a couple possessions. But I'm like, keep her from having to play more minutes at this time while she's still not 100%. Like, Anytime she goes to the floor, I gasp, and I'm like, oh, my God.
Well, and Sundell had an ankle injury. She had to miss a good portion of fourth quarter. Terrence Sides had a big three to tie the game, and then she had a turnover at her pocket pick, but then came right back down and took it right back. So that was a pretty big play by Sides there.
Yeah, Taryn was very important in the fourth quarter for K-State.
And that, there's that depth we talked about that K-State women do have. The KU women have won, had won five in a row, but they lost at number 24 Baylor last night, 69-61. They're 15-11, 8-7 in the Big 12, and they now will host K-State coming up Sunday in Lawrence, which is a huge game for, you know, obviously both teams. For KU trying to get into the tournament, for K-State to try to stay in the top 16 so that they could host the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament, and if you win those two games, then you're in the Sweet 16, and then who knows what might happen. So that's a little wrap on college women's basketball from last night. Big 12 men's hoops last night. Oklahoma State wins at Cincinnati 80-76. In the AAC, Wichita State won their just their third conference game as they beat Tulsa 79-63 in Wichita. And they are now 11-16 overall, 3-11 in the AAC. LSU took down number 17 Kentucky last night. The final 12 seconds were bananas. Kentucky hits a bucket. LSU doesn't call a timeout. They miss a shot in the lane. The guy then gets the rebound. He's got flying behind the backboard, makes a perfect pass to the guy in the middle of the lane to put it up at the buzzer for about 4 feet. And at the buzzer, LSU beats Kentucky. Kentucky ranks 17th. The final was 75-74, which leads me to this. And by the way, still to come, a Royal that is retiring and the Mahomes rules. I'm sure you can't wait to hear about those coming up here in a moment. So yesterday, you and I were talking about this. You know, we talked about it because UConn got blown out by Creighton the other night. Number one team in the land. UConn had won 14 in a row, and they lost at Creighton. And Creighton's a top 15 team, so they're good. They're good, especially offensively. And we were talking about how UConn is not unbeatable. They're not dominant. There's nobody in college basketball that's dominant. We really haven't had anybody dominant in college basketball for at least a few years. So who's going to win this thing? You know, and we went through the whole list, and we're like, you know, you came up with 10. I went with 12. I had Baylor and Kentucky as maybe right on the edge. I said, okay, I'll throw them in there. You know, Kentucky's really talented. Now Kentucky loses last night. But that doesn't change anything for me, and they could lose four in a row. If they make the tournament, they're still dangerous. And then, you know, Baylor, I think, is still a very good basketball team. But it's so odd that we talked about this yesterday, and then I saw this on Twitter that was posted. 95.5% of the men's national champions since 2001. So that's a good 23-year window here, okay, barometer. So in the last 23 years, 95.5% of men's national champions in college basketball have had a top 21 KenPom offense prior to heading into the NCAA tournament. 91% of the men's national champions since 2001 have had a top 31 KenPom defense prior to entering the NCAA tournament. There are only 8 teams in America that fit that bill that have either one or two of those, okay? So you have to either be top 21 in KenPom offense pre-tournament or top 31 KenPom defense pre-tournament. One or the other or both. There's only 8 schools that match this criteria. So if you're trying to figure out who you're going to put money on and you believe in these numbers, which they're not 100% guaranteed, 95.5%, 91%, although that is pretty good percentages, I've got bad news for KU fans. They're not one of these 8. The 8, and so now we'll just go from the 8. It's almost like a beauty pageant where we've narrowed it down to the final 8 here. It's like an NCAA tournament, right? So UConn is one of those teams. Houston, Duke, North Carolina, Purdue, Arizona, Tennessee. And you and I yesterday agreed that those are 7 that we thought of our 10 or 12 that could win it all. And I have Kansas as one of those teams that can win it all, too. I know that seems weird right now, but trust me, their starting 5's good. There's longer media timeouts. They get the right matchups. They definitely could. I'm not predicting they will, but they definitely are. I think, I mean, look at all the wins they have against some of these teams I just mentioned. How can they not? They beat UConn. They beat Houston. They beat Tennessee. How could Kansas not be considered if you've beaten half of these teams on the list? But the 8th one is very interesting because it's not one that we considered. We didn't even think twice about it. Creighton. Creighton got the Elite 8 recently. But they haven't been able to get over the hump and get to the Final Four. And Doug McDermott's had some really good teams over the years. Maybe this is a year that they do.
Did KU beat them in the Elite Eight, didn't they?
Yeah, KU beat it. It was Sweet 16. It was Sweet 16.
Okay.
Because Creighton, I think, in the Elite Eight lost to San Diego State. Wasn't that last year?
It was.
I think it was last year. Or maybe it was Sweet 16. They lost to San Diego State, if I remember correctly. And I think Creighton was like, this is the time we're finally going to get there. I think that's right. You can look that up. See, as I get older, the years just blur together. Yeah. To me, it feels like UConn won the title 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was actually last year. But UConn, Houston, Duke, North Carolina, Purdue, Arizona, Tennessee, and Creighton, they're the only eight schools that fit the criteria that I just mentioned. So Kansas doesn't fit it. Kentucky's not there. Who was another team that was in the top 25 that doesn't? Iowa State's not there. They're ranked sixth right now. Texas Tech is not there. So basically we're saying there's eight teams based on these metrics.
Yeah, San Diego State beat them in the Elite Eight last year.
Oh, I was
1 point, 57-56.
I knew and it was really tight at the end. And that was everybody I know. I have friends up in Nebraska were like, this is the year Creighton's finally getting there. So that was last year. And they were so close. So maybe this is the year that they break through. But Creighton is one of those eight that meet those metrics. Turning our attention to baseball, former Royals All-Star first baseman Eric Hosmer announced his retirement yesterday. What is he, 30? He's not that old. Like, how old is Eric Hosmer? I forgot to look that up. Is he 33, 34? Well, how old is Eric Hosmer? He's 34. He's not even that old. Oh, to retire when you're 34. How sweet would that be? Eric Hosmer announced his retirement yesterday. Hosmer enjoyed a 13-year career with the Royals, the Padres, the Red Sox, and the Cubs. He had 1,753 career hits. He was a World Series champion, a four-time Gold Glove winner, won All-Star Game MVP in 2016, won a Silver Slugger in 2017. He was originally the third overall pick in 2008 by the Royals, was up in the big leagues by 2011, finished third in Rookie of the Year voting that year. He spent seven seasons with the Royals, was best known for his performance in the 14 and 15 postseasons. He was 3-for-4 in the pivotal 2014 wildcard game with a 12th inning triple and a game-tying run against the A's. He had a clutch bloop single in Game 2 of the 2014 ALDS against Houston, his 8th inning RBI single in Game 6 of the 2015 ALCS against Toronto, scored Lorenzo Cain from first for the game-winning run. I was there for that. That was insane. And that was after the rain delay. And he's perhaps best known for his aggressive, albeit kind of dumb, base running in Game 5 of the World Series that year against the Mets when he scored a routine grounder to David Wright. You know, that play by Hosmer was still bad base running, but great base running. And I know that doesn't make sense. But on the surface, it was a horrible decision. But it was a brilliant decision because the Royals had scouted the Mets and they saw something with Duda that he was not a guy that was ready to. And the same thing with Jose Bautista, and that's how Cain scored from first on a Hosmer single because they knew Bautista would always throw it to the middle to a cutoff man instead of throwing it towards home.
And David Wright, too, because he had altered his delivery because of an injury to his shoulder, so he wasn't throwing it like he normally does from third, and it was taking a little extra time.
Yeah, which meant that he couldn't check the runner at third as much as he would normally. Yeah. And so the Royals, it was a brilliant move, but all Lucas Duda had to do was set his feet and make a throw.
Absolutely.
And Hosmer is a dead duck.
Yeah.
And then people go back, see, I told you Gordon should have went home.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's a little bit different. Because there was already a couple bad things happening on play. What are the odds something else is going to happen bad on that whole thing? But, you know, and then Duda became a Royal not too long after that. But it was the element of surprise. That's why it worked. It was the element of surprise. It caught Duda completely off guard. David Wright was caught off guard. And that tied the game. And this was Game 5. If the Royals lose Game 5, the Mets had their best pitchers lined up. There was no guarantee the Royals were going to win the World Series. They could end up blowing a 3-1 lead like they came back for 3-1 leads back in 85 against the Blue Jays and the Cardinals in the World Series. And when he tied the game, and Harvey was so dominant that night, and they left him in too long, as we know. Dude, Hosmer, if he's thrown out at the plate there, was that going to be the third out of the inning? I don't remember. But the Royals lose the game. If he gets thrown out at home, they lose Game 5. Now they go back to Kansas City, and the pressure's counting the Royals with the Mets having their best pitchers lined up.
Exactly.
Because they had, I think, DeGrom and Syndergaard ready to go. So that was an amazing, huge, dumb base running move, which was actually brilliant because of the element of surprise. But it wasn't dumb based on the report and the scout that they had. But on the surface, you don't teach kids at any level of baseball, hey, on a routine grounder, right to third, right to your left, you hesitate and then take off on the throw to first. And you don't do that at the pro level. But the Royals did it in the biggest moment in Game 5 of the World Series. And, of course, we know what happened after that. They had all the momentum. You knew when Hosmer was safe. At least I thought so. Once he scored, Mets were just done. And the Royals were going to win in their extra innings, and they did. So, you know, Hosmer, what he did in his career at the Royals, he's going to be a Royals Hall of Famer, as will basically everybody on that World Series team. But the thing that you can't quantify about Hosmer, he was an amazing, outstanding leader in the clubhouse.
No, for sure.
And when he left the Royals after 2017, reportedly he turned down a $100 million offer from the Royals, which I can't blame him when he was able to get $144 million from the Padres. And I said at the time when we talked about it, Hosmer has to take a significant discount to stay. That's the only way he stays. Otherwise, we should let him walk because he's not worth $144 million. And he proved to not be.
Definitely.
The Padres got a guy that, they got a guy that could hit 16 homers, 70 RBIs, hit 290, nice serviceable player. He had gold glove defense in KC, but when the Padres, his defense declined rapidly. He became kind of a joke with the media out there in regards to how badly he started playing the last couple of years with the Padres. And there was expectations. I still think the Padres, one of the biggest reasons they overpaid for Hosmer was they wanted his presence in the clubhouse. They were paying for that more than on-the-field production because they had some young guys. They were trying to turn the corner. And like, here's a guy that we need somebody at first base. Let's go ahead and get Eric Hosmer. They had money to do it. And so forth and so on. And then they had a salary dump in 2022, the Padres. They released him. He was released by the Red Sox after he was traded to the Red Sox. And then after 31 games with the Cubs last year, he was released in May. Hosmer says he received offers this offseason but decided instead to call it a career. Eric Hosmer's best season in the big leagues was in 2016. Okay, so that was a year after the World Series. He had 25 home runs, 104 RBIs, hit 266. He was an all-star and won the all-star game MVP. 2017 with the Royals, he played in all 162 games. He hit 318, 25 homers, 94 RBIs. So you could argue, you know, the 2 years after the World Series were his best years statistically, offensively. He was a gold glover 4 out of 5 years with the Royals. When he went to San Diego, his first year with the Padres, he dropped from 318 to 253 batting average. His homers dropped from 25 to 18. His RBIs dropped from 94 to 69. In 2019, decent year, 265, 22 homers, 99 RBIs. Then he had COVID. So you can't really count that year. Year after COVID, hit 269, 12 homers, 65 RBIs, and then the Padres decided to move on from him in 2022. So, you know, he had one pretty good, solid year with the Padres, and that's about it. Obviously, his best years were with the Royals. Was he a superstar? No. But he was a tremendous leader, and without Hosmer, the Royals do not make it to the World Series in 14 or 15, that's for sure.
No, the thing about it was, like you said, the Padres really kind of brought him in to be that guy in the locker room and in the clubhouse. What you can't like quantify in an actual measurement is the emotion that he brought to that team, too. Like, he just... If they needed a boost and a charge, man, he had that celebration where he'd put his backpack on, right? And like he basically putting the team on my back. And he did that a lot just for motivation, just for keeping everybody together. Fell on the sword a lot for Yordano Ventura. I remember that, right? Like, and then he was finally tired of it. And he's like, we got to be better. We got to do better things. And so
people said that it covered the Royals. A lot of people thought Salvi was a leader, but they said the first person that you go to with anything that involves the team, anything that you think is controversial, anything that you think might rub the Royals the wrong way, you talk to 35 first.
Yeah, and he was going to – he filled that role and fit it well.
He did a great job.
He knew what it was and what it meant and how to keep the team together for the goal that they had in 2014 and 15. And he was, without question, my favorite player on that run.
Hosmer's career, he ended up hitting 276, which is not bad. His career, 198 homers, so just shy of 200. He had 893 RBIs, so almost 200 homers, 900 RBIs. He did strike out more than people may know. Mm-hmm. He was a solid defensive player, Gold Glover, so more than solid with the Royals. His defense definitely declined once he went to San Diego. But he's got millions of reasons to enjoy retirement. There's no doubt about that. So we wish him nothing but the best, and he'll be back in Kansas City for the Hall of Fame induction into the Royals Hall of Fame without question.
Definitely.
You know, would the Royals put them all on at the same time? Like, would they put – because it was Moustakas, it was Kane, it was Escobar, Hosmer, and Salvi that came off the – well, actually, it wasn't Salvi because he was still good. But they were the five, you know, that mm-hmm. you think about. And they're all going to be in the Royals Hall of Fame. But it was Esky, Moose, Kane, and Hosmer that came off the field. Remember when we all knew that was probably about it for those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to believe how long that's been since then. You know, Alex Gordon was a big part of that team. Gordon's retired. Hosmer's retired. Lorenzo Cain retired recently. Mike Moustakas is trying to make a big league roster. He was in the bigs last year. Alcide Escobar is still playing but can't get invited to a camp right now. Kelvin Herrera is a mayor in the Dominican Republic, so he's retired. Ned Yost is on his farm enjoying life. Salvador Perez is the last man standing from that 2015 team, Salvi, and he's still a Royal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I could see them. It would have to – I mean, there's votes on all that stuff,
sure.
So you can't always just make it to where you'd bring them all back for one Hall of Fame mm-hmm. ceremony because they might not all be voted in. There's a fan
right.
vote that's part of that,
right.
too. But I could see if it was Hosmer, Moose, and Kane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Escobar is going to have the numbers to get that honor.
Oh, I think he's in the Hall of Fame. I don't think there's any question about it.
His
postseason play,
yeah.
He was also the ALCS MVP.
And I get that, but
I mean, I think
his regular season numbers don't warrant being in the Hall of Fame is basically what I'm saying. And it's not just a postseason, obviously, honor. So
it's not like Kane's numbers are off the stress.
No, and I'm not going to be surprised if he gets in. I just mm-hmm. don't know if he's going to meet the criteria to be able to do mm-hmm. it. And Kane might not either, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Kane's ahead of Escobar
mm-hmm.
in that regard.
I would agree. Well, he's more popular. Yeah,
yeah, and I think he had better... Mm-hmm. You know, even fielding and all that stuff that's mm-hmm. involved with it. But I think Hosmer and Moose are pretty much locks, right?
Oh, sure. Like, and Salvi.
And
Salvi, obviously.
Yeah,
Alex Gordon.
And I'm not talking about Salvi because he's already there and he's still there.
Right.
I'm talking about this group. Because
Alex Gordon.
Maybe Salvi would be part of that if they would all get in the same. Alex Gordon's going to be separate from all that.
Yeah, probably.
He'll have his own night, I promise you that, when mm-hmm. he gets into the Hall of Fame. Unless there's more
well,
older
and
players.
I think Salvi will be by himself, too.
So I think they do all this... together,
Royals.
Whoever does make it in mm-hmm. 1 year, they all meet at the same time. So
yeah.
Could be somebody from 2015 and somebody from 1973 that gets inducted on the same night or something like that. But yeah, I feel like those will probably happen at different times for like Gordon and Perez than they will for the others because they're going to be right in there whenever they can be.
Wade Davis, a Royals Hall of Famer?
I think people will vote for him as mm-hmm. fans. The longevity of his career as a Royal might hold him back, but I think he is.
I don't know the criteria. Like, if you have to play so many games or years with the Royals to be a Hall of Famer for the Royals. We're talking Royals Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I don't either. But it is pretty amazing, you know, how quickly things can change. That's why, Chiefs fans, you really need to absorb and enjoy this ride.
Don't just pass it by.
No. Sports Ticket brought to you by Kiefer Brothers Automotive in Beloit, your home for fast-friendly auto repair. All right, we end with this. Speaking of the Chiefs. Did you know that there are Mahomes rules?
I saw something about this the other day.
So the Raiders interim head coach, now the permanent head coach until he gets fired at the end of this year, Antonio Pierce, says that his Raiders will be channeling the bad boy Detroit Pistons when they play Patrick Mahomes as long as he is Vegas's head coach. Pierce discussed how he got his team ready to play the Chiefs before they pulled off their 20-14 Christmas Day upset in Kansas City, which was the Chiefs' last loss of the season before they went on to win Super Bowl 58. And the week prior to the game or before the game, Pierce, then the interim coach, expressed to his team that they need to hate the color red and showed them videos of famous boxing and MMA fights and how the NBA's Detroit Pistons approached playing Hall of Famer Michael Jordan in the late 80s with a tough defensive game plan devised by Coach Chuck Daly. Pierce said on a podcast yesterday, "We've got the Jordan rules and what I'm calling from now on, as long as I'm here, the Patrick Mahomes rules." So you remember when Jordan was going through it with the Pistons, all those guys in the 80s before he became Michael Jordan, Air Jordan, the Pistons used to whoop his ass. Anytime he came to the hole, elbows, feeling him, love taps, we touched him, we're in the head, mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually, I'm touching you. So I showed those guys Jordan getting his bleep whooped. End of quote. In that Christmas Day game, the Raiders sacked Mahomes 4 times, 10 quarterback hits. Raiders scored 2 defensive touchdowns in 7 seconds, including a pick six of Mahomes. The 4 sacks tied for the second most of Mahomes in a game in his career. After that game, the Chiefs were so distraught that they went out and won 6 in a row. You know, fully never recovered from that Christmas Day miracle that the Raiders had beating the Chiefs. And, oh yeah, they won 4 playoff games, including a Super Bowl win over the Niners. Pierce, who was hired as the team's head coach after the season, said on his podcast that the Raiders have given the NFL the recipe of how to beat the Chiefs. Well, if that's the case, then the last 6 teams the Chiefs played are dumber than a box of rocks. Because if the recipe was there, none of them followed it.
They decided to toss the ingredients and do something different, apparently.
There's a great recipe to beat Mahomes. Let's just ignore it. Coach Andy Reid of the Chiefs said this month that he texted Antonio Pierce a thank you for helping his team refocus by beating it that day. Reid sent the text as the Chiefs moved into the Raiders facility, which was the home for the Chiefs before the Super Bowl. Pierce said the Chiefs using the Raiders facility at Allegiant Stadium before the Super Bowl will serve as motivation for his team. He said his team needs to win the AFC West if it is going to achieve its goal to become a consistent winner. The Chiefs have won the division 8 years in a row. Pierce said, and I quote, "We've got to win the division first. We've got to knock off the team in red. They've dominated for 8 years. We've got to knock off the head of the snake, 15. We've got to do that first." End of quote. Okay, a few things here. I like Antonio Pierce. He is old school, which I think old school is not going to beat the Kansas City Chiefs. All right?
No.
Hey, old school, running the football, even if you run for 200 yards, you still got to give the ball to Mahomes at some point. You settle for field goals, you're not going to beat the Chiefs. You can play super physical, but guess what? If you take some cheap shots at Patrick Mahomes, you're going to have players that are going to get fined by the National Football League. Mahomes will be protected, as Tom Brady was protected. Mahomes will get more protection than he has in the past as we go forward longer on in his career. The NFL wants to protect their star players, in particular their quarterbacks. So if the Raiders play a few of these cheap shots, if that's what they're going to do, or play dirty, hopefully it doesn't end up, you know, wrecking a career or hurting Mahomes to where he misses the rest of a season. But it might obviously cause some fines or suspensions from the league office that the Raiders want to go as dirty as the Detroit Pistons were back in the day. And let me tell you something. Antonio Pierce might be your coach, but if you're a Raiders player and you do one of these things, or you want to be super physical and do all this, whatever, and elbow him when he's on the ground, once you get fined in your pocketbook significantly, coach ain't going to be here very long anyway. Money, we can stay longer than Coach Pierce. Players are going to be like, nah, I'm not. I'll play hard, but I'm not doing any of this other stuff. And I'm not saying Antonio Pierce is telling people to play dirty against Mahomes. What he's trying to say is play super physical, play aggressive. We want to hit him as much as we can. You know, if we knock him out, we knock him out. Now, I think Antonio Pierce would be like, you know, if it's borderline, I'm cool with it. And I think that's what I'm actually surprised some other teams haven't taken that tack, to be honest with you. You know what? Go ahead and get your 15-yard penalty and take a shot at his head. You know, I will say the NFL is more of a buddy-buddy league than it used to be. We don't talk about the NBA is always that way. The NBA didn't used to be that way. Now it's just, well, you see the All-Star game, you know exactly what happens. Let's not touch anybody or breathing on anybody. And it's like, oh, buddy, 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 buddy. And even when they lose, it's like, hey, man, heck yeah, yeah, let's hang out. That wasn't the day. And
Marty Schottenheimer's texting Art Shell.
Oh, yeah.
No.
That never happened. You know,
it wouldn't happen.
Marty Schottenheimer wasn't thanking the Raiders for anything. Okay? The Raiders could have given $1 million and he would have turned it down. Marty Schottenheimer hated the Raiders. He called it Raider Week. And then the Raiders, of course, John Gruden did the victory lap around Arrowhead after they beat him. And then the next year they came. They stomped all over the logo, and the Chiefs beat the crap out of them. So, listen, I like the best line I've seen on Twitter in reaction to Antonio Pierce is from Curtis Siebold, my good friend at 810 WHB in Kansas City. He put on Twitter, and I quote, "Antonio Pierce said his team has the recipe for beating the Chiefs, and I agree. Get 2 defensive touchdowns in a 7-second span, and you win by 6. Remember, the Raiders scored 6 points in that game offensively. That's the recipe to beat Mahomes? The Raiders in that game, if I remember correctly, Aiden O'Connell threw for 60 yards the entire game. That is not a recipe. That is an abnormality. Okay?
Yes.
And if that's your recipe to beat the Chiefs is counting on two defensive touchdowns, Antonio Pierce, you're not going to be coaching this league very long. You don't have anything figured out here. You had a day where the Chiefs were off. All right? They played poorly. You played all right. It's not like the Raiders played great. And the Chiefs still almost won at the end. That's what's crazy about it. And by the way, the whole AFC West, there's already Sean Merriman, former Chargers, says the Chargers are going to win the West this year. So here we go back in this whole big circle. I've seen it on Twitter. Here's the whole circle cycle that happens. You start with Chargers are going to win AFC West. The Chiefs aren't going to win the AFC West. Then you go to the Chiefs are leading AFC West. Then you go to the Chiefs have won the AFC West. The Chargers are eliminated. And then you go to Chiefs win the Super Bowl. And we go back after the Chiefs win. You know, six Super Bowls in a row. The Chargers every year are going to knock them off. And it's just pretty hilarious. Well, now we got Harbaugh. Okay, well, you had Khalil Mack, and you added that guy, and you added this guy. Then we got Justin Herbert, and we got this guy, and we got that guy. This is the year. This is the year. Okay, so this was on Twitter. I thought it was pretty good. The Chiefs have no rivals. None. And he's talking about the division.
Yeah.
Because I think the Bengals and the Bills are
Bengals
a bit
and
of
Bills
rival.
Are rivals right now.
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't think the Ravens really are yet.
Not,
because they
no,
just haven't played them enough.
Not played them enough.
Right.
Yeah.
But here, this is a good point. This is in the division. The Raiders haven't won a playoff game in 22 years. 2002. The Broncos have had 13 starting quarterbacks since Peyton Manning retired and seven consecutive losing seasons. And the offseason Super Bowl champion, LA Chargers, have won one playoff game since 2014. And I'll add to that, and Justin Herbert's only played in one playoff game, and he's 0-1.
With a, what was it, a 27-0 lead?
Yes, yes. Now, this person does say that the Bengals aren't a rival either. The Bengals beat KC in one playoff game and needed Mahomes to have the worst second-half performance of his career to win by three in overtime. Well, this person is forgetting the Bengals did beat the Chiefs in regular season twice as well.
Yeah, battles that come down to the wire pretty much every
time.
And
he says the Chiefs have no rivals. The Bills are 0-3 in the playoffs versus KC in the Mahomes-Allen era. I disagree with this person on the last two. The Bengals are 3-1. Burrow's 3-1 against Mahomes head-to-head. They're 1-1 in AFC title games. So to me, that's a rival. The Bills, Josh Allen has beaten Patrick Mahomes a few times in the regular season, so it's not like he's 0-for. I would agree that if the Bengals haven't, Burrow hadn't beaten Mahomes at all, or that Allen had not beaten Mahomes at all, that they would not really be rivals. But to me, they are legitimate threats, although the Bengals are way more legitimate than the Bills, because the Bengals have actually beaten the Chiefs at Arrowhead in the playoffs. The Bills have never beaten the Chiefs, whether it's in Buffalo or Kansas City in the playoffs with Josh Allen versus Patrick Mahomes.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to stick to the division. We talk about, the Raiders are their rival. Yeah, okay, they are. Chiefs have owned them. They beat us on Christmas Day. Which would you rather have, Raiders, a win on Christmas Day, or we hanging out at your facility getting ready for Super Bowl 58? The Chiefs have more playoff wins at Allegiant Stadium than the Raiders do. Think about that for a second, okay? Mahomes has more wins at Allegiant Stadium than the Raiders do, whatever. There's all kinds of numbers out there. But then think about why the Chiefs won eight division titles in a row. Well, first of all, Andy Reid. Secondly, Mahomes, the last six. Travis Kelce been part of all of it, blah, blah, blah. The reason is, one, the Chiefs are the best team in the division, have been, clearly. But the Raiders fire their coaches left and right, hire the wrong coaches. They haven't won a playoff game in 22 years. The Broncos have been an absolute hot mess since Peyton Manning retired. And they hired some interesting coaches, and they went all in on Russell Wilson as he is a declining player. The Chargers always look good on paper, and then either have excuses that they had injuries, or this or that, or their coach goes for it too often. And at the end of the day, they rarely make the playoffs, and when they do, they blow a 27-0 lead with their outstanding quarterback. So I agree with this person. The Chiefs really have no rivals in the AFC West. And as Bob Huggins, I've used this comment many times over the years. Bob Huggins, when he was hired at Kansas State, they were asking about the rivalry with KU, and he said, you know, in order to have our true rival, you have to beat them every once in a while. And you know what would really make it a great rivalry? Is if we would win at their place. And he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Okay, the Bills have won at the Chiefs' place. The Bengals have won once there with Burrow. And yes, the Raiders did win in Kansas City this year on Christmas Day. But we're talking about you have to beat them on a somewhat semi-regular basis. The Broncos have lost, what, 17, 16 in a row? Yeah. So are they really a rival when you dominate them like that? I don't know. The Raiders, you know, we talked about that. That's always going to be their biggest rival because there's the hate there, and Pierce has added to that, which is great. I love that for the rivalry. Mm-hmm. You don't think the Chiefs are going to be ready to kick the Raiders' butt in Arrowhead next year? And then the Bills, or not the Bills, the Chargers. And, you know, the Chiefs always find a way to beat them. No matter how talented the Chargers are, there's not a hated rivalry between the Chargers. There never really, to me, has been.
No.
The rivalry has been the Broncos. The Raiders is the hated one. The Broncos is the, I think, the annoying. And they still hate them, too. And the Broncos hate the Chiefs now even more because they've had a lot of success. The Raiders and the Chiefs is pure hatred. Marty Days, we talked about that. The Broncos and the Chiefs, I think there's a respectable hatred, if there's such a thing. The Chargers is just like, hi, you're the new kid on the block again. Oh, yes, you're going to beat us and win the division again. That's sweet and all. We'll just keep beating you and tearing your heart out at the end of games. We'll let you hang around for a while.
It shows in my fantasy philosophy when I don't have Raiders or Broncos on my team, but I'm cool with Chargers being on my team. Right? There's just not the same thing. And,
absolutely.
And what's weird about that is probably the Chargers are the closest one to compete with the Chiefs for the division title out of all those teams over the past 10, 15 years, right?
Absolutely.
Except for when Peyton was with the Broncos, obviously. Then it was the Broncos, but yeah. I wanted to say, like, real quick, the absurdity of talking about Mahomes rules yesterday. Like, the Jordan rules, yeah, I get you trying to compare that, right? The Jordan rules were put in place before Michael Jordan ever sniffed a championship.
Right.
They were put in place to stop him from winning a championship, to stop him from dominating games. And the Detroit Pistons were the kings of the castle at the time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they were ruling the Eastern Conference at that time when the Jordan rules were in. I don't understand.
Mahomes has three titles.
How are you going to try to wake a beast that's already won two championships and been to five straight at the time when they beat him? Right? He's basically saying we put the Mahomes rules during this regular season, and that's how we won the game. We put the blueprint together. Right. So at that point when they played, he had two championships and five straight AFC championship appearances. You're not blocking this dude from anything. He just won another championship. The Mahomes rules makes no sense. Like, I can see if he said it right after the game, made that comment. It still doesn't make sense because he's already won two championships.
Right.
But you can make that comment right after the game. But you're now saying it after
they won.
He's already won the third title.
We have the recipe.
Now we have the recipe. Well, they won six in a row, and their recipe was not used apparently by anybody else. They might have tried to, but they didn't do it. They didn't get lucky like you did and get two defensive touchdowns in less than 10 seconds. It's just absurd, the timing of that.
Let's think of the ingredients in this recipe, all right, for all those chefs out there. Let's think of the grandiose ingredients of the recipe to beat Patrick Mahomes, okay? Score 6 points on offense, because that's what the Raiders did.
Yeah.
Okay? Have Andy Reid feel sorry for you and call some trick play inside his own 15 that is fumbled and recovered by the Raiders, okay, for a touchdown. And it was windy conditions that day. A Mahomes pass that was slightly behind his receiver who did not come to meet the pass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it wasn't Mahomes' fault. It was not a good pass, but the receiver didn't come meet it. I think it was Watson. And it was a pick six. So you have the recipe to beat Mahomes, which includes a trick play that blew up in the Chiefs' face, which is them shooting themselves in the foot. A pick six by a guy that doesn't throw a lot of interceptions and rarely throws pick sixes. And your quarterback, your recipe to beat the Chiefs is Aiden O'Connell as your quarterback, who threw for 60 yards, I think, that game, or 60 in the second half. And you scored 6 points on offense, and you scored a total of 20. And still, at the end of the day, you had to sweat onside kick or whatever it was to finish the game. And the Chiefs played god-awful that day. Your recipe to beat the Chiefs, your ingredients are a trick play that blows up in the Chiefs' face, a pick six in a windy condition day, and a receiver not coming to meet it, and an ill-advised pass by Mahomes, who doesn't make many of those. You're going to count on that every time you're going to... Good luck with that. Good luck with that. And I would argue the Chiefs even looked past the Raiders a little bit in that situation because the Raiders weren't great, although the Raiders were playing better at the time. But that's your recipe. Your recipe is trick play failure, pick six in a span of 7 seconds, and your quarterback throwing for 61 yards, and your offense scoring 6 points. That's not a recipe for success. That isn't a recipe at all. Okay, that's an abnormality. And Antonio Pierce may want to look that one up. But I'm sure he's saying all this stuff because he wants to make his team believe and he wants to get in the head of the Chiefs, which is stupid. That does not work.
No.
Not with Mahomes. It doesn't work against the greats. You don't get in their head. And were the Pistons in Jordan's head? Yeah.
Absolutely.
They were. But like you said, it was when he was younger and he didn't have as much of a supporting cast. That was before Pippen really came into his own.
Yeah.
It's before Grant really developed into a terrific player. I mean, this is not even comparable. The only comparable is he's basically saying that Mahomes is Jordan. That's what he's saying.
Exactly.
It's a compliment from that standpoint.
It is, for sure. That's 100% a compliment on that issue, and that's exactly what he's saying. And I think not too many people are going to disagree with that, right? The time to get in Patrick Mahomes' head was his first year starting, and,
absolutely.
And he got off to such a hot start and great start that nobody could. Like, nobody's had the opportunity to ever get in his head because he started so well.
Yes.
And, you know, that did not happen for Michael Jordan. He didn't just come out here and just dominate and with his team from the go. I mean, he had to go through it, and, you know, second year had the big injury, and he had to do some things and overcome some things. And to look at what Mahomes has done, he's really never had to overcome
right
that mental part of it, I don't think. I mean, he was ready for it. That's the thing, is like he was ready to go, because obviously I think the time he spent a year in the system and learning from Alex Smith, and obviously being around a professional clubhouse and locker room as a kid and being around all those pros and picking things up there. So his mentals were pretty much ready when he stepped on the field.
I think the only adversity that Mahomes has truly faced in regards to his professional career, other than injuries, of course, and he had to face a lot of adversity this year, no doubt. I'm not sitting here telling you, I'm not telling you Mahomes had a cakewalk, but that's how great he's been. He's made it look relatively easy. His first year as a starter, as you said, 5,000 yards, 50 touchdowns, MVP, blah, blah, blah. And if they had the overtime rules they do today, he would have got the ball. And their overtime rules are made because he was so good against Buffalo that they changed the rules. So he never got the ball against Brady in the AFC title game at Arrowhead that first year as he was a starter. But the biggest adversity to me he's had to deal with was, and this is, it's funny, Pierce talks about he has a recipe. The Bengals presented the recipe way more than the Raiders ever did. The recipe for the Bengals was rush 3, drop 8, play 2 deep safeties. And then, remember, the Chiefs, you know, lost in the AFC title game. He had a horrible second half. Mahomes played horrible the second half. I was so bad I thought he was on the take, because I couldn't believe it. But they had something that confused him. And then the very next year, the Chiefs had all kinds of struggles offensively because the teams were taking that recipe and they were dropping 8, playing some zone. They were not playing man-to-man. They were dropping 2 high safeties. They're taking away the deep ball, and they were rushing 3. And they basically were saying, we don't think Mahomes is going to be patient enough to take the underneath stuff. That was the thing. Like, Mahomes, the Bengals figured him out. And then Mahomes, partway through that season, started to acknowledge and understand that he had to get away from some of his gunslinging ways. I'm going to have to take what the defense gives me. And all you got to do, and how far he's come through passing that class, which I figured, and actually I knew he was going to. It's just a matter of time. When they were like, well, the teams have got him figured out. You just take away the deep ball. Well, he figured it out. Took him a little bit of time. He figured it out. And, of course, we know what happened after that, and he figured it out, and now people are giving him crap because his length of touchdowns aren't long enough. Well, that totally, like, the yards per touchdowns in the playoffs have gone down from 15 yards a touchdown now to 4. He's just a check down quarterback. Wait a minute, you ripped him because he all he did was throw the deep ball. Now people rip him because he doesn't throw the deep ball enough. He checks it down. It's called taking what the defense gives you. If you give him the deep ball, he will kill you with it. And now he has grown and matured and learned from the ways of what the Bengals did in the AFC title game in the second half and what teams did the first part of the next season. He's figured out that, hey, you take away the big stuff, I'll take the little stuff, and I will cut you with 1,000 paper cuts and beat you. And that's exactly what he did in the Super Bowl. He only took one deep shot in the Super Bowl, a 52-yard pass, and then they fumbled on the next play. How did the Chiefs do How did the Chiefs drive the ball down the field against the 49ers? How did the Chiefs drive the ball down the field against the Bills and the Ravens in the playoffs? And the Dolphins. They don't have no Tyreek Hill.
Chunks,
MBS, they're never on the same page on a deep ball. Mecole Hardman doesn't even run out a deep ball asking for a flag. Now he finally ran one out in the Super Bowl. How did the Chiefs score these touchdowns?
Small chunks, medium range chunks at a time. Man.
Matriculated ball down the field. Instead of 4 plays, 80 yards, touchdown, it's now 11 plays, 75 yards, touchdown. Oh, dear God. He threw a 5-yard touchdown pass. And so I saw Seth Kizer. He put out there, he goes, there are people actually saying that Mahomes is a game manager that checks it down too much. And he's still a Super Bowl champion when he chucked it, and now he's a Super Bowl champion when he does it either way. And he goes, and to give you a fact of how misleading that stat is, check out this highlight. And he showed Mahomes his 2-yard touchdown pass against the Buccaneers on Monday Night Football. Remember when Chris Collinsworth said it's just like he's playing with the kids in the playground? He came over the sideline, whoop, and he threw it. That's not a normal 3-yard touchdown pass. So, I mean, there are people that just can always find something wrong with Mahomes, and it's like there's nothing wrong with him at all. He knows how to beat you now in multiple ways. Guess what? The Patriots over time figured out how to beat teams in multiple ways. They always adjusted. They counter-adjusted. The Chiefs and Andy Reid have done the same thing Bill Belichick and Tom Brady and the Patriots did. That's what the Chiefs are doing. They're very similar in the way they've gone about things. You win with a high-powered offense and a decent defense. You win with a great defense this year and a little more conservative offense. You win with a deep playmaker in Tyreek Hill. You win with serviceable wide receivers. You win with a great pass rush. You win with an outstanding quarterback chucking it deep or settling for. The Chiefs can beat you so many different ways, and we've seen this over the past 6 years with 6 straight AFC title appearances. But getting back to the recipe that Antonio Pierce has, I have it pulled up. Dusty, here are the ingredients of beating the Kansas City Chiefs. Here's the recipe for Antonio Pierce. You force 2 turnovers that result in direct touchdowns. That way your offense doesn't have to do anything. You know why? Because your quarterback in that game you beat the Chiefs on Christmas Day was 9 of 21 for 62 yards for the game! The recipe to beat the Chiefs, Dusty, is to get out gained by 100 yards, to give the Chiefs 22 extra plays, to give the Chiefs 7 extra first downs, to go 3 for 12 on offense. That's what the Raiders did that day. That's the recipe, and also average 3.9 yards a play. The recipe to beat the Chiefs, let me repeat, is giving up 7 more first downs than you get, going 3 for 12 on third down, allowing the Chiefs to have 22 more offensive snaps, allowing the Chiefs to have 100 more yards, allowing the Chiefs to have more yards per play, and your quarterback only throws for 62 yards in 4 quarters of football. Yep. Think he's got it figured out. I think Mahomes should just quit now. There's just no way the Chiefs can overcome this unbelievable recipe. This is sublime. This is like the greatest ice cream on earth. You can't mess that up. There is nothing that would defy this recipe at all. Oh, wait a minute. Don't turn the ball over. Solved! Which, guess what the Chiefs did in the playoffs? Didn't turn it over very much. And I'm sure they had some drop passes in that game, too.
For sure they did. They had everything in that game. I'm sitting at home watching it on Christmas Day, and I'm like, this is a miserable time on Christmas. Like, what are we doing here? Yeah, it was.
Oh, another part of the recipe. Another part of the recipe, Dusty, is let the Chiefs have the ball 10 more minutes than you do. Yes, it's brilliant. And only score 6 points on offense. And automatically assume you get 14 on defense in 7 seconds.
Yeah.
That is one hell of a recipe. Pierce has got it figured out. Give that man a lifetime contract, Las Vegas. Do it now. This guy is smarter than everybody else. He is so smart that 6 coaches after that game did not copy that same blueprint. I wonder why. You know, I don't understand why the 6 teams after the Raiders didn't force 2 turnovers for 2 direct touchdowns in 7 seconds. What the heck were they thinking? Dusty, what were they doing? You know, the problem with those 6 teams after the Raiders, their quarterback threw for too many yards. That's why it didn't fit the recipe.
Absolutely.
Oh, God. I love this division. Broncos are incompetent. The Chargers are anointed when they don't do anything to get anointed. And the Raiders are just funny as hell.
State, regional, and national sports talk on your schedule. The Sports Ticket Podcast. Subscribe via Apple, Google, and TuneIn Podcasts or SunflowerStateRadio.com.